2020, Zita Rohr and Lisa Benz published a collection of essays entitled Queenship and the Women of Westeros, Female Agency and Advice in Game of Thrones, and A Song of Ice and Fire. This series of essays explored the intersection of elite women and popular understandings of the medieval world. Powerful women are at the center of the many political and military battles that took place on Game of Thrones over its 8 seasons. Indeed, the series ends after a war between two queens, Cersei and Daenerys, for control of the Five Kingdoms. In our episode today, I speak with Dr. Miriam Shaddis about the representation of queenship and power on Game of Thrones, and how it is reflective, or not, of elite women's access to power and authority in the medieval world. Dr. Shaddis is an associate professor in the History Department at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, where she teaches courses on medieval Spain, the Crusades, medieval women, and food and drink in the pre-modern West, among other things. She is the author of Berengula of Castile, 1180-1246, and Political Women in the Middle Ages, and a number of essays on elite women in medieval France, Castile, and Portugal. Most recently, she is the author of Founders, Sisters, and Neighbors in the 13th Century, Women in Community at Santa Maria de Celes, Coimbra, in Women in Community in Medieval and Early Modern Iberia, edited by Michelle Armstrong Partida, Alexander Garrison, and myself, Dana Wesselay. She is currently working on one study of early queens of Portugal from 1100 to 1250, and another on queens of Leon from 1126 to 1230. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today, Miriam. I'm really looking forward to our conversation, as the topic of queenship and female power is so central to Game of Thrones, but also my students are really interested in, and several of them are writing papers on this exact topic.
You're welcome. I'm excited to be here.
I want to start with a question about the relationship between women's access to political power in the Middle Ages and how it's reflected on Game of Thrones, because I think this is a theme that is really prominent in the show. So how reflective is Game of Thrones of women's access to political power in the Middle Ages? And can we see examples of women ruling as queens in the way that Cersei and Daenerys and Sansa end up doing on the show?
The answer is going to be yes and no, right? It is reflective in some ways and then totally not in other ways. And I spent a lot of time thinking about those three women and this problem in terms of what we know. One of the things that struck me about the whole thing in general, you must talk about this in studying medievalism, but is that with the novels and then the TV show, we have a lot of backstory. We see a lot of development and we can see the evolution of, you know, Daenerys's power, for example, and how she, you know, manipulates her husband, but she sort of trains him up. She gets him to be where she wants him to be. And she's able to build her power from that point. We can see that. And for a lot of, maybe even most medieval queens, and frankly, most medieval kings, we don't see that. We don't really know how they learn to do their jobs. But we can see the structures that are in place in terms of legal systems or religious ideas or family structures, traditions, all those kinds of things that go into shaping how a person ends up in power. And I think in that regard, there's a distinction between power and authority. So power is this expression of strength and this ability to make things happen. And one of the articles that you read talks about Cersei as, you know, really in the end in it for herself. And we learn that more from the novel than we do from the TV show, but she wants power and she's willing to do whatever she can to have that power. And for most of the show, we see her as trying to achieve that through her children. And I think that access to power through children is something that we see a lot of medieval queens have. And when they don't have children, that can be a problem for them. Or when they don't get along with their children or they're separated from their children, that can be a loss of power. So that makes a lot of sense to me. The other piece of it, though, is this question about authority. And that's more the kind of what the legal framing of something, the right to rule. And I think that in the Game of Thrones, the only queen that I think of as having fitting into that kind of trajectory of a systematic right to rule is Sansa. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's super interesting because she is the one, first of all, we do see her grow over time, but she's the one who is, to me, the least interesting character for the longest time right? Yeah. She's annoying. And she's subject to all the fairy princess stuff. She believes that she's going to be the beloved wife of this Prince Charming. And she is disabused of that notion quickly.
Yes.
And over time, she comes into her own. Yeah. And then you want to see more of her because it's very appealing. But she is there because, first of all, through marriage, that is what sets her up to be a queen. And then eventually through blood and through inheritance. I mean, that's how she becomes the Queen of the North, is that she is Eddard Stark's daughter. And it turns out that she has some talent and she can also wield power. But I think in terms of the structures that set up the potential for queenship in the Middle Ages, you really are going to see people either achieve that through marriage and family. Well, it's always going to be through family because we're talking about dynasties, but it's going to be mostly through marriage. So most queens become queens because they marry someone who becomes a king. So there are queens who become queen through inheritance. They are the daughters of the king. Maybe there's some in Scandinavia, but I can't think of any instances where a queen inherits from a queen, which mm-hmm. would be super interesting. So we have queenship by inheritance a little bit, and then we have queenship through marriage a lot, and Sansa fits both of those things. Whereas Daenerys, she has definitely that family background, right? That's mm-hmm. a big part of it. But that's not what sets her up as a queen. She doesn't derive her authority from her family, really. She derives it from taking power. So it's a yes and no answer. My opinion would be that Sansa is the one where it's easiest to see historical parallels. There are a lot of women who, like Cersei, are mothers mm-hmm. who are able to really come to their fullness of their power as queen mothers, or as regents for their children, or even just as advisors to their adult sons. So that makes some sense. You could say that that's an appropriate possibility. Mm-hmm. Although the way the character in Game of Thrones executes that relationship is not collaborative.
No, she's using her children. And I imagine there also aren't any queens who seize power themselves to rule after their children die. Do we have any examples of that?
No, although I can think of one example yeah. I really like and don't know enough about, which is Maria de Molina, who was a queen in the late 13th and early 14th centuries. And she is a regent for her child and then for her grandson. So she steps in, but it's not like she seizes power and it's not like yeah. she keeps him out of power. And she's quite old when she does that. But you can see generational situations, right? Yeah, I think there might be some other examples where grandmothers are super involved in the Ottonian dynasty. I think that there are some.
So. Where they come in and act as regents in place of children who are minors. And I think we expect that type of behavior. Perhaps what people find so shocking about Cersei is that it's clearly done for personal motivations and desire for power rather than, I think there's an argument to be made that she does care about her children, but I don't know that she cares about her children as rulers. I think she cares about them as her children necessarily.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about the show I think that is very affecting is that Jaime Lannister and Cersei Lannister are so human in their passions for mm-hmm. each other and for the children. And they talk about the children as our children. You're like, oh, that's so yucky. But they're just, yeah. they don't care because they love them yeah. as their children. But I think in terms of Joffrey or Tommen being yeah. the king, she doesn't care.
yeah. Yes, they become a way for her to access power.
Yes, exactly.
So you've talked a little bit already about this, about how women gained political power in the medieval world, but are family relationships and lineage really the main way that they gain access to this power?
I think that, yes, it's the main way, but I think that we can make it more complicated by understanding that these family relationships are more complex than we might otherwise mm-hmm. expect. And there's a couple things I want to say about that. One is that, first of all, I think it's really important to appreciate that Game of Thrones super simplifies the hierarchy, the strata of yes. society. And so we don't see great examples of powerful individual lords and ladies. There's a little bit of that maybe with the Tyrells, but they all have a relationship to the royal family in a kind of a way. And maybe the Greyjoys, you have these little families. I just think that when we think about political power, it's really important to remember that it's not just at the top. In the same way, yeah. it's not just the king by himself. He rules with a consortium, usually of yeah. his wife and children. And so in the same regard, you don't have this king who's ruling as a sole monarch. There's lots of layers yeah. of power there. So that's number one. And so when you start to think about that and how elite families in general placed people into political and powerful positions. One thing you can really see is the power of being in the church. And so for women, that's a little bit more subdued than it would be for men, because there's only so high you can go, right? You can't become a priest or those kinds of things. But you have a lot of very powerful women running monasteries who have great influence at court and who are advisors to their brothers and sisters, and probably, I'm going to speculate, but sometimes in charge of the education of royal children. So there's a way of having influence and power that we might not expect. And then the other part of that is, even apart from the religious institutions, I know that in Iberia, which is what I study mostly, there's a lot of room for royal siblings, and in a very significant way. So in Castile, for example, there are a couple of generations of kings who really rely on their sisters. And that's one of the funky things about the Cersei-Jaime story. It's too bad, I think, because but it plays into some really stereotypes and the aspersions that are cast often on powerful women, that they get everything through sex and all this kind of stuff. But there really were women who were royal women who advised their brothers, were close to court, signed all the documents, controlled vast wealth, and often were more important than the queens. Like the king had his wife, and she was doing her wife job, which was usually to have children, and she'd be there, but she would not have the kind of influence that the sisters would have. And I think that the jury's out on exactly why that kind of relationship emerges, but it seems to be, again, about how power was structured altogether. For these kings to really have control, they needed people that they could rely on, someone they could trust, someone who knew them, someone who was invested in the same system that they were part of. And it would be a sibling as much as anybody else who would, and a sister would probably be a lot less threatening than a brother.
Because we do have examples, of course, of brothers who try and use their royal brother's power in various ways and challenge them for the throne, whereas it seems sisters will be less likely to do so.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think the relationship between Jon Snow and Sansa is a good example of that, right? When he's king of the North and he leaves her to rule over the kingdom for him. This week in that class, we're talking about children. And one of the episodes that we watched, there's a scene where Jon and all of his advisors are talking about what's going on and how they're going to fight against Ramsay Bolton and retake Winterfell. And Sansa plays this really crucial role as his advisor in explaining to him how that he can do this. They comment on the fact that there's no Stark. No one's going to follow Jon because he's not a Stark. And she says, well, I'm a Stark. They'll follow me. And so I'll go and talk to them and I'll get them to be on our side. And so I think that's a really good example of that importance of the sibling relationship to help. And that's a question I have too. So do we see examples of illegitimate children that are embedded in that same type of way to uphold the monarchy in the same way?
I think we do. So I'm really interested in the illegitimate children or the natural children, in part because one of the queens that I study is in theory an illegitimate daughter of the king of Leon and Castile. So the woman who is the first queen of Portugal, Teresa, is her mother was not the queen. Her mother was a Bata, probably. And potentially even not really that, because potentially she was born while her father was still married to another woman. So it's super complicated legally. But the fact is, doesn't matter. She is given all this wealth by her father as a marriage portion. He doesn't mean for her to become a queen, probably, but she does. And she's able to move Portugal right out of the clutches of the Leonese. So she was the queen. And that's a super interesting problem. It's all about, is it enough to call yourself the queen? Does that mean you're the queen? There's all these things that are going on there. So I'm interested in this problem. And I can think of ways in which various royal families avoided having natural children or embraced them. But overall, it seems that in the period that I'm familiar with, which is really the 12th and 13th centuries, you can see plenty of examples of very powerful men and or women who are the illegitimate children of the king and who step into important roles. They might become important clergymen, but they might also be given really fantastic marriages and serve the king at court or go and serve the cousin king at his court as military leaders or things like like that. So I think in general, non-threatening, loyal core that the king can rely on. And it's just that interesting thing that goes on in the Game of Thrones with the Robert Baratheon's bastards that are sprinkled everywhere and they're out trying to kill them all, right? Because there was a lot of discussion in the reign of Henry VIII about whether or not his son, Fitzroy, could become the king. And there was a kind of an assumption that he might be, that Elizabeth was just as much a bastard. And that's another thing, right? This notion of legitimacy and illegitimacy really is dependent upon the needs of the current moment. But there are certainly examples of powerful people connected to the royal family. They serve a role.
When I teach about monarchies, I try and talk to my students about the fact that we need to see it as like a corporation, right? They have a goal in mind that they want to fulfill. That's a business goal that's developed through personal ties. And so there's all these different people that are embedded in ensuring that goal is carried out, and they play all these different roles. But we need to think of it not as an individual, as you said, who's ruling, but that as someone who's working together with the people that can help him or her succeed and ensure that their family is going to succeed too.
Well, when you were talking before about siblings and asking about siblings and John and Sansa, I was thinking a little bit about also the whole role of women, more women than men in connecting courts to each other. A really famous group of sisters are the Sisters of Provence. So you have Louis IX is married to Marguerite, and Henry III is married to Eleanor of Provence, sisters, and then there's Sister Sancha and a sister Beatrice. There's four sisters anyway, and they have these relationships, but they keep their sisterly relationships and they serve to bond their husbands to each other. And then there's a royal bastard, sort of, the daughter of Alfonso de Molina. So Alfonso de Molina was the younger brother of Fernando III of Castile. Okay. And so we're in the 13th century. And Alfonso has a number of children. And one of his daughters, who's named for his mother, Berengaria. So she's known as Berengaria Alfonso. She has his last name. She becomes one of the last and most influential barraganas of Jaume I. And she ends up at his court. So he's much older king at that point, and she's young. And he talks about her in his memoirs. And we know that she's there at court for a while. And she serves a really important purpose because she's helping tame some of the relationships between Castile and Aragon at the time that were pretty tense. And she serves as this kind of unofficial official link.
Yeah. Right?
And she has the status because she's royal, but she's also his concubine in a sense. Yeah. It's super interesting.
That's fascinating. I think the role that, particularly for the Stark family, the role that the girls play, Sansa and Arya both, in furthering their family, but also the fact that Arya struggles with, am I a Stark? Am I not a Stark? How do I fit into that? One of the things that we're going to talk about is the role of noble daughters. What happens with these noble girls, both in the medieval period, but also how that's represented in Game of Thrones. So it's a really fascinating question about this role that the noble girls play, right, for their families and how that's represented in the show. We've highlighted a little bit about the depiction of powerful women in Game of Thrones. And when I was looking for material the first time I taught the course, but also more recently too, especially now that the show's over, it's interesting to see how writing on women has changed. So popular media writers are kind of split in the way they describe the powerful women in Game of Thrones, which I found super fascinating. Some argue that the women are reflective of Martin's supposed feminism. And in fact, I found several articles where he claims that he's a feminist and he has these feminist ideas, that's an interesting argument. And then others critique the way that these characters fall into stereotypical tropes. So if someone asked you, what do you think? How would you describe the portrayal of female power on the show? What would you say?
Well, if they predicated it by saying, Martin says he's a feminist, I'd be like, that's so interesting. And what does it mean to be a feminist? Because I think that's really the crux of the matter. So we see definitely women have a lot of roles there. I'm not sure, but I think Game of Thrones would pass the Bechdel test. I mean, you have women having conversations with each other about usually killing somebody's child, but they're there. Yeah. So I think that in some respects, sure, you've got all these women, and frankly, characters like Arya and Brienne of Tarth, they're all pushing these boundaries that are really titillating to the audience and please people because they really want to see that. And so I was thinking about this earlier a lot, and I would say that it would be wrong to expect any kind of feminist vision of them. And I think we can see women depicted as powerful women, and we can relate that to actual real powerful women. And we can see all the kinds of restrictions that are placed on them and the challenges that they face. So two things. One is that there's that famous quote that's in one of the articles. And then also, you remember, Cersei says basically, I'm stuck with babies in a blood moon or something. Like she's like laying it out there. Why is it my brother gets all this stuff and I don't?
Yeah.
And I sort of think you're not going to find much ever, maybe anything, from a medieval author who is female articulating that kind of resentment. You might find somebody articulating the facts, like this is how it goes, or something like that. But you're not going to find a challenge to any patriarchal structure or norm. And Cersei's not, she's exploiting it. She's not actually challenging it, but she's articulating this thing. And that's, to me, is a modern screenwriter's fantasy about the past. Yeah. That they have this idea that women would have been like boiling over with resentment. And so I think it's actually a really sexist position, right? Yeah. It's like the permission that Cersei gets to be incestuous. There's all these things that are really ugly. And because she's a woman, she gets to articulate these things, I think, in a way. So I have that issue. And then the second thing, and this gets us back to the first conversation about Sansa, which is that if you took out the dragons and the magic and whatever the heck is going on with the faceless men, and you took out all that stuff, right? Then you're left with women like Sansa who have marriage and family and blood, and that's the structures of their power. So I think that the fun, I think it's fine, it's there, but it doesn't represent anything real. And I mean, in a dangerous kind of way, because you would be mistaken to see Daenerys, for example, modeling any kind of historical reality, I think. And so that's a problem for me in terms of how the women are presented, because what gives them so much power, the Red Woman, come on, she's amazing, but she's also really not real. And so her amazingness is located in her manipulation of the occult. The thing that is so challenging about this kind of fiction, and one reason why it's appealing to use it, and like same goes for Harry Potter, frankly, right?
Yeah.
Students, like, is that it does get some things real, some right things. So do we have an example of Brienne of Tarth? No. Do we have an example of women putting on armor and leading armies? Yes. So, okay. So you can imagine this. You can imagine that this is a possibility. But that's getting away from your question. I guess I would say I have a pretty strict definition of feminism. No.
It doesn't pass the test.
But before I ever knew about Game of Thrones, before it was ever a TV show, I had students coming up to me and telling me, oh, you would really like this. But I think for them, it really brought the concept, the possibilities of the past alive. And so that was a good thing.
We've had a great time in the class talking about how it's much more interesting to talk about Game of Thrones as an example of medievalism than to think about it in historical accuracy or authenticity. Because if your conversation is about accuracy or authenticity, it doesn't really go anywhere, right? There are no dragons. It doesn't really go anywhere to do that. And then you start getting down into details that aren't helpful in thinking about history. But if you think about it in the context of how people imagine the medieval period and how that it claims to represent the medieval period and how popular audiences interact with that, and then the impact that it has on how people think about medieval history, that makes it a lot more interesting, right?
No, and I guess I just want to like really emphasize the point that I think the only issue is that all the magical stuff and all the medievalism stuff is so easily, it's not that people think, oh, there were dragons in the past because George R. R. Martin says so. It's rather that they think, oh, women have this amazing power. Define amazing power. Yeah. Everybody was living on the edge. I really have this feeling too.
Yeah.
The other thing, they're like, I just saw a book coming out. It's in proofs right now, and it's called Paths to Kingship in the Middle Ages. And on the one hand, I really want to read it. And on the other hand, I really want to like slam my head against it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, kings are subject to all these things too. Maybe not the same degree, and they have military power, and that's different. And, they win. It's patriarchy and they win. But I think in terms of like the limitations that are placed on people, everybody was really very vulnerable.
So Game of Thrones has a lot of powerful women on the show, as we've talked about. We see these women, but ultimately it ends up as a battle between two queens, right? In the very last season, which is incredibly problematic. I've spent a lot of time talking with my guests about just how frustrating it is the way it ends. But the end of it is this battle between Cersei and Daenerys, and neither of them survived. Neither of them survived the battle that they sparked. Yeah. So what do you think about this context of the fact that these two women who seize power and are able to set themselves up in having authority and aren't like all the things that we think about, right, as being rulers, and in the end, they're killed and we end up with a male king. So what do you think about that? And in the context of women as rulers?
That's a very hard question, actually, mm-hmm. because I think by the time, when I was watching the show, and by the time I got to that point in the show, I think I had ceased to think about women as rulers. And yet there was something about, especially Cersei's demise was so prosaic, trying to escape and crashed down these bricks and that's the end, right? I was like, that worked for me. I thought it was appropriate because it was so, again, it was like seemingly random, but so realistic. And in fact, you watch all these films where all these cities are falling down and everybody comes out of the rubble. And you're like,
they all survive. Yeah.
But it was interesting because I think one of the things that you can see happening to her towards the end is that she's losing all of her followers. She doesn't have really any support. She's losing that war. And she has become even more horrible. I mean, she's always been horrible, but she's lost you. You don't have sympathy for her anymore. Yeah. And she's lost all her followers. But I think also that in her mind, she still has a chance, right? In her mind, she's still going to make something happen. And when she can't, it's yes, of course, this is the end. It just underlines how, I don't know, how nothing glamorous anymore, nothing exciting or powerful, but just crashed in dirt. Whereas Daenerys, I had a hard time actually tracking her increasing insanity. Mm-hmm. And that's how they justified it, right? In the end, like they made her into this mad Targaryen and nobody could put up with that. So there's this double thing there where there's this insanity in her family, but there's also, she's a mad woman and she's out of control. And so in the end, it's Bran who's the king. And he's interesting because he's degendered in a lot of ways, right? He has a disability. He's really the three-eyed raven. He's really all these other things. So he's almost a puppet. I wonder what would become of him, but it's odd. So he's not your typical, as if, for example, Jon Snow had become the king or any of the other military guys. So I do think that's, I mean, it's not like they could have just made Sansa the queen, I guess, but they did. So I didn't really know what to make of that ending. And I think by the time that show was winding down, I was thinking that Cersei was like, how can she keep hanging on? So I was personally ready for her to go.
Yeah, me too.
And I think that you're right, though, that you could see it as this showdown between these two women. I suspect that is quite a literary trope where you have no victors, right? Mm-hmm. You have this massive conflict and nobody wins at the end. But it would be very interesting to know how often that was two women have a massive conflict and two women, then really nobody wins.
And nobody wins. It's interesting too, that given that we, especially that we know historically that in order for monarchies to survive, they need to have this clear line of succession and they need to have this clear familial support, but Bran can't have children. Right? That's made somewhat clear in the show. And so what happens when Bran dies? But that doesn't seem to matter, right? Because at the end, the Starks are the successful family and they're successful because they stuck together, because they supported one another.
I guess for her, I'm going to keep writing.
Yeah.
Keep going. You go back to Jon Snow. He'd be the one, because I don't think Sansa's, I mean, you get the sense that Sansa probably can't have children either and or won't.
Doesn't want to. Yeah. Yeah,
doesn't want to. Who knows?
I want to come back to Sansa because she's been a thread that we've pulled through this. So she's the only queen left we have standing, right? At the end, Sansa Stark, who, as you said before, she takes the traditional path, right? The path that we see in the medieval period of gaining access to power. And we've talked a lot about her in our class, in our discussion of sexual violence. We're going to talk about her this week, and I'm thinking about noble girls and some of their experiences. But she, over the course of the show, she changes from this kind of stereotypical noble girl, where she talks about, as you said, the dream of marrying the king and having his children, to becoming a queen of an independent north at the end. So what do you think about her representation as this kind of typical noble girl? Is she the one that where we can see this representation of the experiences of noble women in the past, more so than in the other characters?
I don't know. I mean, it's interesting because the story starts when she's about 12, right? Mm-hmm. Or 13 and she's going to be married. And mm-hmm. this is the plan. And that is completely in sync with what we might expect for elite women, whether they're royal women or just noble women. And, but for the most part, we don't have any inkling of their lives. I know when I talk with my students about these kinds of things, they often are very put out by, you know, people have no choice. Girls get married off. Now, this is true, but would they have expected it to be different? And we have to really think a lot about how much expectations shape people's experiences. Like when you go into something and you are told your whole life, this is how it is, and it's all you can see around you. I just wonder if it's as horrible as it would be for us, because we have this sense of agency and independence and value that. So in Sansa's case, I think that at least from the outside and structurally, this is, yes, very, potentially very typical. And in fact, bringing the Stark bloodline into the royal family would be something that would be very important to people. The fact that her mother had successfully had a number of children would be important, right? Yeah. Like all those things make her a valuable piece in this game. And I am skeptical that it's typical is any kind of fantasy that a young woman like that would have about what she was stepping into. I really don't think that would be even something that would be like an alternative fantasy. There is a lot of really lovely medieval romance literature that talks about love and talks about passion and beauty and all these kinds of things and really plays that up. But I think everybody understood that this was an alternative, right, a fantasy. And I don't think that it was something that was an alternative in the sense of only I could be like a Marie de France's favorite character or something like that. It wasn't there. We have insight once in a while into people's relationships and how they thought about them. And we have Eloise's writing about Abelard and the frustrations that she felt about marriage. And so she's not royal at all, or she's maybe elite in some way, but not really. But she articulates a contemporary vision of the potential. But I hesitate to say that it could not have happened. But the fact is that of the thousands of young women across the Middle Ages who are married into situations like this, we just don't have any evidence whatsoever. I do think one of the things about Sansa's story that is probably useful to think about is how it changed on a dime. All of a sudden, husband is dead. Oh no, what are you going to do now? Yeah. And that was very real for people, that things could just switch. And women in particular would be really vulnerable in those situations. They might not be liberated. It might not be a freeing moment. It just would depend. I'm trying to think of anybody in Game of Thrones. Well, Lyanna Stark does die in childbed. Otherwise, you don't have that kind of precarity. It's really your men getting killed off that's changing the trajectory of your life. And I think Marjorie Tyrell is also maybe a good parallel to Sansa up to a point there. I mean, Sansa persists and she becomes this smart, cold-blooded, powerful woman. And frankly, I did. I wish we had more of her in the story. I wonder if the novels will have more of her. But the young women, I think that she does. From the outside, she definitely represents a very common trajectory. And then all of the circumstances that change over time, that's what's going to affect what happens to people, whether they fall into obscurity or whether they end up living long and productive lives, as we say, kind of thing.
And I imagine if a woman ruling as queen and her husband then dies and her son is old enough to take the throne, I imagine her relationship with that son and with other people is going to really impact what's going to happen to her next. Would a dowager queen be able to live without conflict? Is her relationship to her son important in order for her to exist without conflict?
So the women that I study have, you know, pretty good relationships with their sons and in fact have a lot of power, a lot of power for decades after their husbands die or they're divorced, in their case. Yeah. But there are, for most of the Middle Ages, like I think from starting maybe in the 8th century or so, elite women had marriage contracts. They had agreements, dower agreements that were made that were explicitly to support them after the death of their husbands. And I think you do see a number of cases where women essentially taking their sons to court or they're, you know, going to court or suing for their dowager rights or their properties. And I think Eleanor of Castile is one of these people who really pursues her dower. And so that's about wealth. And they're not, generally speaking, vulnerable. And as queens, I think that they manage pretty well, even if they're in reduced circumstances. Widows in the populace really had a tough time and would often have, unless somebody really wanted to take care of them, they could really be in dire straits. But I think that for the queens, can't think of any examples of out and out disaster. In my mind, I can imagine a couple of cases where somebody just goes to her country estate and that's it. We don't see her anymore. And lots of complaining, lots of letter writing, lawsuits and things like that.
And presumably they'd have their own natal family to support them too.
I think that just really depends. I think a lot of these women end up in a foreign land and they stay there. So a good example of this is Berengaria of Navarre, who married Richard the Lionheart and goes to France, and Richard dies and she's stuck there for some time, for a couple of decades. And she spent a lot of that time petitioning to get her dower, and she never goes back to Navarre. I don't even know. Sometimes you can see them trying to get one of their royal brother to speak on their behalf or something like that. But I think a lot of times those brothers are like, you're his problem now.
Presumably, unless they want to use her to marry someone else, she's young enough. So my last question for you is, how might Game of Thrones challenge the broader public's perception of women's access to political power in the medieval world? And can it help us counter the belief that women were subjugated and held no power and authority?
Wow. I don't know what the broader public thinks, honestly. I think people expect and recognize queens. We have a queen. We all have Queen Elizabeth. We can envision this. So I think the series might do two things that are contradictory. One is that it can make sense to people because there are these queens and they're part of the story and all that. I suspect that some people might find it a little hard to believe that queens had that much power, right? That they could act with that kind of agency. I can imagine that somebody would say, oh, that would never happen. Right?
And I've had people tell that to me, right?
Okay, good. So So I can imagine that now the question is whether or not that person saying that would then take it further and say, let me find out if that could ever happen.
Yes.
If they won't, then they're just going to say, well, this is a fantasy and we all know this is a fantasy, and they'll leave it at that. But I do think, like I was saying before, I think it gives you some space to imagine some things and to visualize maybe some possibilities there. I think that something that is important about that story that can be useful to us in thinking about history is that it really lets the individuals be very complicated. Mm-hmm. Right? They're not hidebound by conventions. Mm-hmm. So something we haven't talked about much, but I think is really an important distinction for the Middle Ages is the role of Christianity in organizing most of the West, and at least being dominant in most of the West. And so you have the church, and you have many churches, and you have people's piety, and we know the huge variety of degrees in which they are engaged with that. But my experience of talking about the Middle Ages a lot of times to people is that folks be like, oh, well, everybody just believed X, or the church had all the power, or women couldn't do this or that or the other thing because church. And you always are trying to explain that it is so much more complicated. And I think that something like this show, if people approach it the right way, because looking at women, they say, well, look at all the varieties of possibility here. And yes, we have to tone it down, no dragons. You could have a woman, for example, who has a way to garner tons of loyalty. How does she do that? Is that impossible for a woman to have the loyalty of her followers? Is it impossible for an old woman, Olenna Tyrell, right? I mean, to me, she's a super fascinating character because she's still in it to win it. She's like old and everything. She doesn't care. And she has the last word. She's forced to commit suicide. So it's the possibilities that this opens up that I think is good. I'll be positive about that.
I agree. I think it opens people's mind up to the possibility that women were able to play these roles, which is important, I think, to talk about and to be recognized beyond the academic world.
And to understand how integrated they might be into a system. It's not just there was this extraordinary, exceptional woman, but rather there is a place for women like this to do these things.
Yeah.